Loading in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the Restaurant Coach Podcast. It's the cure for the common restaurant. Expert interviews, tools, and tips to get you the restaurant you know it can be. Now, here is your host, Donald Burns, the Restaurant Coach.
And welcome to the Restaurant Coach Podcast. This is episode number 15 with a good friend of mine from Shamrock Foods, Ron Bo Bryant. The man is a wealth of knowledge about food service operations, distribution, and running a successful restaurant. So take a listen to this one and get a lot of gold nuggets out of it. And welcome to another RCU live event, sponsored, of course, by the Restaurant Coach University, the premier online learning platform for restaurants that want to make a difference and maximize their potential. You know, restaurants face a lot of challenges in 2017, and sometimes being aware of some of the common mistakes that consultants see out there can help steer you clear of the same mistakes and save you some pain down the road. And so to help me uncover some of those restaurant mistakes, I am honored to welcome international restaurant consultant and author of seven books, Bo Bryant, to the show. Bo, hello. How are you tonight?
Donald, what's up? You have a real sexy radio voice.
That's my radio voice. I know, huh?
It's good. So, how are you, man?
I'm good. Real good. You're out in sunny California, right?
Yes, sir. For the rest of the day. Then I'm heading to beautiful Durango, Colorado tomorrow morning.
Oh, nice. Yeah, Durango's nice. It'll be pack your long johns. You'll need them. Trust me.
Sweet. Thanks.
Yeah. So, hey, for people who might not, you know a little bit about you or your story, why don't you tell people a little bit about who you are and what you do and how you got into this crazy world called the restaurant industry?
Oh, wow. That's a good one. All right. So I'll try to give you the consolidated version. Grew up on a cattle ranch in Montana, raising cows and corn and alfalfa. It was a lot of hard work, and I thought it would behoove me to find an easier job. So I decided to jump into the restaurant industry.
I don't know if it was easier.
Believe it or not, it's still, well, maybe not easier, but certainly had more perks, right?
A lot more perks.
Yeah. I had a better audience being in the restaurant. So, you know, early I fell in love with just the gypsy culture of what is the restaurant industry. Mm-hmm. I don't have a better way to explain it. And, you know, I knew pretty young that my craft would be the restaurant industry. Went to culinary school, worked front of the house actually before I ever even was interested in culinary or back of the house, and then developed my back of the house skills, then owned some restaurants, owned a bunch of restaurants, but it was all training to open my first one, and I realized how little I knew. So I did what every failed restaurateur does. I got into consulting. I'm just kidding. Actually, my first restaurant was successful. We sold it. Successful in the sense of cash flow and profitability and how much I sold it for. Not successful in the quantity of hours worked. So that was pretty terrible. But it taught me a great lesson. It taught me to step away from the environment and figure out how to reapproach it in a way that didn't require 100 hours a week. So anyway, for the last 20 years, I have been doing restaurant consulting and development, concept development. I'm a curator of all things restaurant. I own a software company, as you know, a restaurant-related software company, written a bunch of books on the restaurant industry, on the restaurant industry, and work today and for the last 5 years specifically with emerging concepts, big concepts that have the ability to grow, the financing to grow, but not maybe necessarily the best practice or know-how, wherewithal, whatever. So it's an incredibly humbling job, and not a job. I mean, it's what I love more than anything in the world, but it's humbling in the sense that I've never done anything before where I had to be so attuned to the environment in the sense of not just teaching, but learning. When you work with all these big concepts, I mean, every concept has wonderful redeeming qualities. In these really big, complex, elaborate networks, you know, these 10 to 500 units, these guys have solved for things that other people never even knew were broken. So much incredible creativity, but then at the same time, on the other side, there's that 80-20 rule, you know, the 80% that I'm there to fix is overshadowed by the 20% that they're doing better and different than anybody else out there. So it, yeah, I learn something new every day. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That statement is true, but I've never, ever been in an environment before where you don't just hope to learn something new every day. You have to be, present and really ready and maintain the rest of the flow of the work, the observation and all the other stuff that you're doing. For the teaching part, because trust me, it'd be easy just to be a participant, you know, a passive observer. But while you're trying to engage and fix at the same time, it's really dynamic. But I wouldn't trade it for anything in the entire world. It is absolutely what I love doing. So did that give you enough? I kind of go off on tangents.
No, it was good. I know, I like your tangents. You have good tangents. We've known each other for quite a few years, so yeah. And I find sometimes when you and I get in the conversation, we tend to get in the flow, and like, you know, next thing you know, a couple hours have gone by and we're just like, you know, they're closing places down around us, like asking us to leave. And they're like, oh man, we got to go. So, you know, you work with a lot of restaurants. What would you say are three common mistakes that restaurants make, you know, that restaurants make out there? And how can people listening avoid some of those same mistakes?
So this is a big question. So I do this every single day, and on average, you know, I work with about 9 clients at a time, full scope projects too. But they're always in different phases. And, you know, I mean, I've got some clients that are right now 2 restaurant locations that, you know, have the funding to jump to 10 overnight, but we've got stuff to fix. And then I've got, you know, my largest client right now just did a huge development deal, for a total of 500 locations. So it's the whole spectrum.
Yeah,
and so when you ask that question, I'm trying to temper my answer because, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. You and I had some conversation about this. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. What are the most common mistakes that people, there's a big scope, right? There are independents that do stuff that is just intuitive because they don't necessarily have the education or experience in doing it. And there's a whole bucket of common stuff there. And then there's these really experienced guys who get in their own way because of their ego or whatever it happens to be. They've had and tasted some success. And so they just assume that, you know, they can ride that horse into the ground and never fail. So within that spectrum, if I were to not classify it by buckets of restaurant types, I could give you 3 or 4 of the most common and pervasive mistakes I think that restaurants make. So the very first one, it could probably be articulated a lot of ways, but I would explain the first one by an underdeveloped or missing brand identity.
Yes.
One of the first things that I always do is we put our clients through discovery and dig into their business and interview their people and figure out where they want to go and where they are and what's in between. The very first thing is, as a part of that checkup, is to get your finger on the pulse of that brand identity. Do they know, not do they know, can they explain, and more importantly, are they all on the same page with the explanation? If I ask them the question, this question came from John Mackey, CEO of Whole Foods. It was a great, great question. Why do you exist? Right. That was it. That was real simple. And an opportunity to interview John Mackey and pick his brain about this amazing success of Whole Foods and just that culture and the branding and everything that they did. You know, the guy shows up with a loaded question before he can even ask a question. And it is, why do you exist? And maybe it was even, why should you exist?
Right.
And that seems silly, but I'm telling you, it's a very, very big statement. Yeah, I know your why. I have this process that we train to called the Whydenity. And you can't explain as an entrepreneur, as a restaurant owner, why you felt compelled to risk your hard-earned money and take this gamble in this pervasively hard to succeed in business. You're willing to put it on the line because you felt like you were going to fill a hole that everybody else has missed. That you should be able to articulate that. And then you should actually be able to articulate it in what I call a 3-second story, a 30-second story, and a 3-minute story, right? It's the elevator pitch kind of revisited, but most people don't really give a shit about who you are, what you know, or what you do. If you can't sum it up in 3 seconds, you lost them. But if you caught them, then they'll want to know more. So you have to have that 30-second story. And then, you know, the 3-minute story is dribbling on, the stuff that I do all the time. So the brand identity is the biggest one. We build a bunch of construct around that. You know, it informs everything. So I'll tell you my little four-wall theory here. If you have your identity captured, you know why you're here. That's your entrance strategy. If you know where you're going, that's your exit strategy. Well, those two things conveniently turn into your purpose statement and your vision statement, right? And so when I help people to try to fix their businesses, I have to understand, in order to populate this roadmap to success, where's the beginning and where's the end, right? Now, if you look at that like climbing a mountain is normally how I tend to explain it. I'm climbing a mountain, and on one side of me is the edge, and on the other side is the sheer ice. So what's going to guide me? So that's the mission statement, and then the other part of it is the value statement. There's a lot of ways to win, but there's the ethos or that ethical part of you that dictates what's the way that I'm going to feel good about winning. So when I paint those four walls around a business and say, okay, this is your chinois. This is what's going to allow every decision to either pass through or get held back, right? Just ask every decision you want to make about your business. Ask those four questions. Is it aligned with why we came into the business? Is it aligned with where we're going? Does it fit our mission, the way that we're going to get there? And is it aligned with our values? It's got to be yes to all four of those. If it's not, you got to go rework it, or you got to dump it in the trash, right? So whew, that was only one. There's three, you said.
Hey, we got time. Don't worry.
All right. There's no rush through these. Hang on.
No rush. We got time. Have some water, man. We got time. People are hanging. That's good.
All right. So the next one is the biggest mistake that people make, I think, is how they view their employees. We're in the people business. We're not in the show business. We're not in the food business. We're not in the restaurant business. We're in the people business. And I'll take it a step further. This guy, Howard Behar, who was the founding president of Starbucks alongside with Howard. You'd think I'd remember the founder's name. Howard Behar, Howard Schultz. Mm-hmm. Howard Schultz was the big money guy, the big idea guy, the guy who worked for Starbucks, whatever. But when he actually bought up the Starbucks brand and took it over in 86, he brought with him this guy named Howard Behar. Howard Behar had this construct of how chain of command works. Mm-hmm. And it's really beautiful, and it's something that I model all the time. I think it's right. Is as the owner and as the executive team, your customer is the employee. Mm-hmm. That is the alpha and the omega, the beginning and the end. There, you don't have another customer other than them. And in turn, when you empower them and treat them like they are the most important thing, you enable them and give them the authority and the power to treat then their customer, which also happens to be the restaurant's customer, accordingly, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, that concept is right. I think too many times operators look at employees as a liability. According to the P&L and the general ledger, it says they're a liability, right? Payroll is a liability, but the people behind the payroll are not a liability. They're an asset. When I see people that, or when I walk into organizations that have a really dysfunctional hospitality feel or a disconnected culture, 9 times out of 10, I can bet you that thinking is the liability-minded operator instead of the asset-minded operator. We hire people lazily, and we expect them to come to us knowing everything and then just do the same work they did somewhere else for us. And instead of contributing to their growth, there's this amazing operator that I worked with out of LA a few years ago. His name was Ron Salisbury. He owns a chain of Mexican restaurants and a really, really nice fine dining concept called down in Newport called crap. I don't remember. Anyway, he made a comment to me about employees, and he had said, my job relative to employees is to put these people back in the world better than I found them. Mm-hmm. And he's got an idea. I love throwing my little nickel ideas out there, or his. This idea was so phenomenal. So during the down season, when, you know, winter time, whatever, out here in Southern California, it's not as busy. He had this concept where in his office of all of his stores, he's got this amazing library of restaurant books, great restaurant books. Some of them on theory, on customer service, on leadership, on the actual practical elements of restauranting. And so he's got this standing deal. You can check out any book anytime. You come back with a 5-page report, a synopsis of this book and what you learned and how you can apply it. I'll give you $200 cash. No questions asked. And to him, he's investing in his people, but his people are also investing in their craft. And incredible win-win. It's like one of the most brilliant ideas. I love to say it on shows. I love to tell it in books, anywhere I can, because I'd love for this to be something that just caught fire in the industry. Not just the book concept, but, you know, putting them back better than you found them.
That's a big thing. That's just like, well, like, you know, you and I both do consulting, and I always say the consultant's creed is always to leave the client in a better position than when you got there. That's always my motto. That's always my goal. I've always got to leave them in a better position.
Yeah, and I think that's good. I can't even tell you what it does for culture. There's this old quote that says, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I like that, especially when it comes to creating culture. If you don't put energy or effort into your people, why would you expect them to do anything in kind, right? I mean, the same in kind anyway. So I could go off on that forever. All right, third one. So there's a tie for third and fourth.
You can hit four if you need to.
Okay, I'll go with the positive first. With independence, now, so this is more independent-based than it is larger successful chains because of cash flow, right? When you're smaller, it's because you're still working to generate that law of replenishing returns. And I would say one of the biggest challenges, the lack of capture. And I'll tell you what I mean by that, but I'll also tell you why I think it's the problem. People don't capture their processes. They don't capture the training. They don't capture the nuance, the story. It's all tribal, which is cool, right? You learn the legacy kind of by getting jumped in, and you stick around long enough, you get and learn more stories, and it's cool. And then those are kind of your ribbons, right? How you can prove how long you've been there is the depth and quality of the stories you know, right?
I mean, battle scars.
Yeah, absolutely. But those battle scars unfold in the form of history, great storytelling. Yeah. And, you know, it's very right-brained, like most of us that got in this industry in the first place. It's that ethereal, artistic feel, emotion stuff, and it's great. But there's a negligence to capturing that, and for posterity's sake, because you never know the whole "what if I got hit by a truck" deal. And then, of course, we see that a lot when restaurants are growing, and the owner has it in his head, and he's got a couple trainers who have it in their head, and they just get stretched so thin that they lose their depth in the brand, and people feel disconnected. So, for a lot of reasons. All right, so I'll give you a quick hack about that. So there's this great little trick that I like to do. Yeah, I even got it right here with me. I've got a couple of these in different formats, but the GoPro.
Oh, I love the GoPro.
I have a Polaroid cube, and it's literally like 1.5 square inches cubed. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have a screen to see what's happening on it, but I have a clip that I put on my hat, and I mount that on my hat. So when I go do R&D days in the kitchen, this is because it's one of my biggest guilty issues that I always feel terrible about, is when I am in creation mode, culinary mode, just pure uber nerding out on food and playing with stuff, I'm just doing it, right? I'm doing it according to palate and flavor and contrast and the juxtaposition of temperature and texture, and I have a great time. And afterwards, someone's like, "Man, that's great. Do you have the recipe for that?" And I'm like, "Shit. Hang on. I can redo it." And of course, I can never redo it. In my entire life, I've never been able to redo it as good as I could in the moment. So that's why I've had to train myself to identify my own shortcomings. I'm telling you, that Polaroid cube on the visor of my hat while I'm cooking, it looks where I look, and it captures everything. And it's a really cool way to capture process or practice or whatever. Then I have a relatively inexpensive program on my Mac. I'm going to have to flip the page on you. It is called Final Cut Pro. I'm sure a bunch of people know of it.
Oh, yeah.
The easiest editing software in the world. But you know what? My kids also have editing software on their phones. There's apps that you can cut stuff, blend stuff, bleed stuff, make something 30 minutes long with a bunch of dead space, 3 minutes long. And with a very small amount of time invested, it returns tenfold, right? So here's right. – and this is a common mistake that comes from the first mistake. Not capturing creates so much inefficiency, not just lack of transition or transcendence, but it's the lack of efficiency. It takes me 15 minutes, literally, to edit an hour-long video, right? Mm-hmm. An hour-long training session that I give somebody. 15 minutes. So that means even if it took me 2 hours, the time to do 2 training classes and not record them and then have to go and do it again instead of just sending somebody a link and saying, hey, catch up. My time is valuable. Yours is too. Instead of us worrying about how to mesh our schedules, go watch this video, report back to me next time we meet, and we'll be on the same level, ready to rocket ship forward. So imagine scaling that back into the restaurant world. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me in every business.
Yeah. And I love the GoPro as far as, using it also too for social media. It's huge. It's so everyone today, if you're not using video on social media, you are a dinosaur, basically. That's what I'm going to tell you right now.
You got a problem with dinosaurs. All right.
So you want marketing on social media nowadays, you got to have video, some video content out there.
So here's an interesting story. So I'm big into technology and technology for efficiency's sake, right? So I used to use this camera called the Flip Cam. It was just called Flip.
And
it was
I remember those.
And it had this USB drive that came out of it. And so it was great. You could plug it right into your computer. So that's what I used to use. And this is, I'm going to date myself a little bit. It's older. I used to tape it to my chest. This is where the idea first came from. When I was in the kitchen, I would tape it to my chef's jacket. And when I would look down, I'd position my chest a little bit. Well, I'd miss stuff all the time and, pointed too high, whatever. But ironically enough, the guy who invented the Flip Cam ended up selling it to a big tech company based out of Denver, like Oracle or somebody like that, right? And so he got gobs of money, millions and millions of dollars. And what did he do with it? He decided to go open a restaurant concept. It is called The Melt. And he was a Silicon Valley guy, and he ended up getting a bunch of big investors on top of his money, hundreds of millions of dollars to blow up this grilled cheese sandwich concept with some really interesting technology, good technology, good stuff. But there's a handful of missteps they've made along the way, but neither here nor there. Just an interesting story to kind of tie it all together. Cause when I first met the guy and I was consulting with him, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. I used to use this to help me in the restaurant business. Now I'm helping the guy that invented this. That was pretty cool.
You actually had like the original prototype of the GoPro. You didn't know that.
Yeah, no, I did. Didn't have all the cool mounting widgets.
If you had the lawyers like Apple does, you could actually sue them. That was my idea. That's my intellectual property.
Taping it on my chest. maybe it was more the body cam, I guess.
It was the body cam. It worked though. Yeah.
It did. Okay, then my fourth one.
Fourth
sorry,
one.
I'm not rushing yet because
you're not rushing. We're good.
It's taking me an hour to answer these four pieces on one question. All right. I think the other biggest mistake that people make, it's pervasive, but I see it a lot more with independents, is a mindset of saving their way to success, right?
Right.
I like one of the most popular things amongst people, one of the most epiphanic things that make the light bulb go off when I do it with people as an exercise are my time studies. So when I look at somebody's the way that they spend their time, I've got this concept that I explain to people. You can do $500 an hour work or you can do $10 an hour work. If you're in California, that 10 equals 15. But $500 an hour work. I did the math one day. I wanted to be making $1 million by the time I was 40 years old. So I had to kind of deconstruct that. And what does all that include? Well, at the time, I think I was 20. I owned my first restaurant. I was working 100 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And I knew, I wasn't going to make $1 million doing that. And certainly didn't want to do it working 100 hours a week. You know, so the money wasn't worth that much to me to have real life and no family. So I said, well, I would want to work 40 hours a week. So I divide $1 million by 40 hours a week by 52 weeks a year, and it comes up to roughly about $500 an hour. So I said, okay, so that's pretty good. So what kind of work can I do, right? I'm not relying on somebody to write me a check for $500 an hour. I'm relying on myself to be able to generate $500 an hour worth of revenue, worth of profitable income, right? Mm-hmm. If I own a restaurant, I could be in the dish pit for, I don't know, cleaning up the shit that got buried because I cut my dishwasher at 12 because I was trying to protect myself from going into overtime from this dude, which I do every week because I'm actually a part-time dishwasher short, but I'm okay with that because I'm saving for the 2 hours three times a week that I wash dishes, I'm saving $60 a week. But when I became fully conscious of this concept, I decided, okay, I'm going to go print off these $10 gift cards and I'm physically going to go walk in, around my neighborhood, businesses and houses, and knock on every door. I'm going to give everybody a $10 gift card, no strings attached, come spend it. Well, I did a little math. My average per person or per table check average was at the time about $86. My average guest count was 2.6 people. So to spend $10 to get $86 back, that had a pretty good ROI for me. So I went and did this, and I did it for like a month straight. And I had this great pitch, you know, like, hey, I'm Ron. I own the restaurant. Love to see you in there. Wanted to introduce myself. Got something really exciting going on in the restaurant this Thursday. We got live music, whatever. Give them the whole story. Hand them a gift card. No strings attached and no risk to you. Come spend some money. Come see what we're all about. And if you don't like it, you didn't have to pay for it, right? So that was kind of the pitch. When I tracked every one of those cards that came back, and I used a specific card unique for just this, the rate of return on it for my investment in time, total time to design the card, print the card, go pick up the card, distribute the card. I mean, I considered all of the soft cost around it, not just my feet on the street knocking on doors. All in, I probably, the ROI was somewhere around $460. Pretty damn close to five, and certainly a lot better than, you know, cutting my dishwasher early and doing $10 an hour work. So that's the concept. So, where was I going with this? Time studies. Yes. So I do time studies with people, especially executives, you know, people in the C-suite. Yeah, I go through an interview. I find out what they do in the day, and I'm scratching my head. Usually I don't have a hard time punching people in the mouth when they're doing stupid shit, but you can't get people to see the light unless they see the switch, right? They got to find the switch on their own. They got to turn it on. So the time study is, for the next week, I want you to document everything that you do in 15 to half an hour increments from the time you walk in to the time you close the computer at the end of the night. Then for 1 week in a little notebook, you get these notebooks anywhere, and you just have to have the discipline. And I've even seen people, you know, that will do it at lunchtime and just at the end of the day or during their meal breaks and at the end of the day. But I don't ever have to read their time study. I tell them to read it back at the end of the week. Mm-hmm. They show up to my next meeting and they're just like, oh my God, I'm an idiot. It's the easiest work I've ever done in my entire life, is just letting people step away from their position, look at it at 500 foot level, and it just blows their mind. So that's a high level construct to the concept of saving your way to success. It's actually opposite, right? Hashtag time study. Absolutely. So when people do that, it's a trigger effect, right? And it starts avalanching, cascading, and they start recognizing, well, I spent some time to go through spreadsheets and see which vendor had the cheapest product. But what I never considered was, now that I'm doing this time study, I see that I spent an hour before I placed the order preparing them. And I did it with two vendors. So now I have to receive two times the orders. Now I have to put GL codes on two times the number of invoices. Now I have to write two times the number of checks to send out. and it takes an extra hour in my accounting department every week. It takes my guys an extra 2 hours a week to receive it all, place the phone calls, chase down credits. When you look at the litany of shit surrounding this bottom line thinking of, well, that was $10 cheaper on an invoice, so I'm the winner. Oh, really? You spent $50 in wasted labor to save 10. So tripping over dollars to pick up dimes, it's one of those things that drives me crazy. Anyway, those I would say are my four biggest things. I don't know if you were looking for mechanical things like the way people Bryn Mawr cut instead of match cut.
No.
Hopefully that wasn't too heady, but.
No, that was good. That was perfect. I mean, yeah. I mean, so just so people know, this is what I call the shameless self-plug. But on Restaurant Coach University, we actually have a course rolling out this week. It's called the Level Up Program, and it's actually a peak productivity system that I teach all my clients. And part of that thing is you always have to do a time audit because you have to understand where you spend your time. And then the next step after that is then I have you go through a calculation of what is your time worth per hour. And then we do the exercise just like you did. We take them and say, now, look at what you spend your time on. Look at what your time is worth. Now, where do you see a disconnect?
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's apparent. It jumps off the page.
Oh,
I catch myself doing it. I actually use it differently personally now. I use it in my personal life. You know, where are those checks that I'm putting into the family bank relative to, you know, what I'm depositing and what I'm withdrawing? And am I giving quality time or am I just in the vicinity, right? So I like to do time studies on that side of it because I want to have that family success just as much as the business success. But
When I was studying, all that stuff, time study stuff, I think there was a thing, something I read about Bill Gates, you know, richest man in the world. And he basically is worth like, or he makes basically just an interest revenue and everything alone. He makes like $100 a second, something like that. It's crazy.
That's awesome.
And, you know, so would it be worth his, you know, if $100 bill fell on the ground, would it be worth Bill Gates' time to pick up $100 bill because he's worth like $114 a second, you know?
Oh, that's interesting.
It's interesting.
I like that. I might steal that. You know, and I say steal it, I mean that with all due respect, but I'm going to steal it.
Dude, I steal from you all the time, man. I read your books.
What's funny is I know so many consultants and different concept constructs that they work with and on as far as restaurants. But, you know, having conversations with you, I got another buddy named Matt. I got another buddy named Mike. These guys that I work with all the time. We didn't go to the same school. There's no school. I mean, it's a school of Hard Knocks, right? It's restaurant and it's growing up in this shit and learning all of the wrong ways to do stuff so that you can find the right way to do it. But that's a long, laborious process, right? Like I said at the beginning, I now am afforded the opportunity to learn off of other people's mistakes and tons of other people's mistakes, but I also get to see what their solutions were and all that just keeps going. But what's interesting to me is bunch of buddies that do this, we all end up coming to the same conclusion, even though we have different ways of doing it, different things that we teach, different methodology. I call it a time study, you call it a time audit. You know, and we're obviously, you know, this is unique to both you and me separately. I didn't know you did this until we talked. You may not know I did this until we talked today, but it is funny to see that we do a lot of the same
process. Yeah. It's like you and I also, too, we also both dig right into the first thing we always dig into, and you and I have talked about this, first thing we dig into right away is core values, you know, right away, because you got to know your values, got to know who you are. We both dig into the why. If you don't understand that, a lot of it's just kind of a waste. And so when consultants borrow from each other, this is the term we use.
Yeah.
Practice.
Yeah. That's practice. That's it.
That's it.
Now, it's cool. It always makes me feel good to see it. You know, I see clients doing stuff. I see really successful clients doing stuff that I would have taught them if they weren't. So you get those affirmations around you, you know. I've been doing this for a long time, and I used to spend a lot of time on the right things, even in the consulting practice, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's what I realized. Nobody needs me to make their food better. You know what I mean? I mean, I've had the honor of being at the James Beard House, invited the James Beard House to cook 3 times and as a guest 4 times. That's great. But guess what? I have not met a whole lot of restaurateurs, operators, and their culinary team that don't know how to cook. I haven't met a whole lot of successful, bigger businesses that don't know how to run their operations. it's not that stuff that they need help with. As soon as I realized that, I was able to start focusing on the business stuff, right? The philosophy, those tools and tricks and tips and the mindset and all that stuff that is really more broken and what leads to everything else breaking.
Exactly.
Whew. God, you'd think I'm still in the restaurant business, man. It sounds like I just did a big line. I get real excited about this stuff.
Naturally. I know. You know, that's what I love, though. I mean, that's why I love talking to you. You know, and that's the thing you're going to see, too, is that people like-minded. You know, you are a compilation of the peers that you hang out with and that you have conversation with.
Yeah.
And I tell people a lot of times, if you want to change your life, just change your peer group. Hang out with people that make you rise the game. Because here's my thing. I owned my own restaurants, and I sold them. And then I went to work for Wolfgang Puck. And when I went to work for Wolfgang Puck, I thought I was a pretty badass chef. But when I went to work for Wolfgang Puck, I realized there were some other chefs out there that were really, really badasses. And I had to really up my game if I wanted to stay in that level. Because those guys, like, they don't, they're like no recess. They don't play, you know. they take it to the level.
There's this concept of you don't want to be the smartest guy in the room, right?
You're in the wrong room, right?
A lot of us end up liking the comfort of being the smartest guy in the room, yeah. But your point, you're not going to improve unless you get into rooms. So I got to a point where I thought my chefing skills were second to none. Then I learned a lot of stuff about less of the how, more of the why, right? And I had this great mentor who used to just beat the piss out of me. I'd come up with these incredible dishes and I'd put them in front of them. And the response was always, you lack discipline. I'm like, discipline? Let me tell you about the techniques and the time that I put into this. It's like, you don't understand. Discipline relative to this one statement that you should ask yourself every time you cook anything. Just because I can doesn't mean I should.
Yeah.
And that really led me down that path of discovering the why. You know what I mean? Like, why does this item fit? Go back to those four walls. Does it align with my brand purpose? Does it align with my vision? Meaning, is it scalable? If I want to grow this thing to 20 restaurants, is that organic buffalo piss water arugula really going to get from back alley California to Denver when I want to go open the store there? No.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? It's like, when you start testing yourself against those pieces, you start learning. But I have this one chef buddy. His name's Troy Gard. I'm not afraid to shamelessly plug him. The dude is – you're familiar with Sam Fox, of course. I think.
Oh, yeah.
Sam Fox is a very dynamic dude. Got a lot of restaurant concepts. Mm-hmm. Sold some big interest in some concepts recently. He was partnered in P.F. Chang's. I didn't know that. I learned that recently. But I got a buddy who reminds me of him, this guy Troy Gard. I think he's on 15 to 18 restaurants over the span of 10 concepts. And he's got this place in Denver he just opened called Mr. Tuna.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a fucking restaurant. It's an art installation.
Oh, wow.
That is like the type – well, I mean, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
You walk in and it's so over the top. It's so crazy, shabby chic, like – artsy, like if I gave a pile of shit to this dude, he could make a shit painting that would sell for like $100,000. And that's the kind of culinary that I don't have. And that's a humbling thing. You know what I mean? Like, I never got to that level. I don't think I'll ever get to that level. That dude is just like the Jackson Pollock of food. I have no idea where this crazy stuff comes from. I remember that dawned on me probably 10 years ago when he did this ridiculous hamachi dish. And he had this crazy herb-infused oil, served on a frozen plate, this beautiful hamachi, a little bit of a truffle essence to it, and topped with pink Pop Rocks.
Nice.
Coolest goddamn thing. It's popping on the plate. You get the crunch. You get the sweet. You get the salt. You get that really rich umami aroma out of that subtle truffle that was in it. And then that real big floral bouquet. I mean, the retronasal smell on this thing, like drinking a wine, you know, just the way – all the flavors came out when you were done, you know, just breathing when you were done. Oh my God, it was epic.
Yeah.
I've known 100 amazing chefs that could have pulled off that same dish and not one would have put Pop Rocks on it. And not one would have had the same level of artistry that dude has. And that's 10 years ago. Imagine 10 years forward, what this guy does, it's insane.
I gotta put out a disclaimer to, because some of my clients are listening in, and I'm gonna say right now, I do not want to see Pop Rocks on your menu next week. All right?
Doesn't mean you should.
No Pop Rocks. Do not put Pop Rocks on your shit next week. There could be a rash of Pop Rock shortage. You know, we should have bought. You know, this would be that we should have bought stock in Pop Rocks, and then mentioned it on air. And then we could have sold short. But then we'd be, you know, in federal prison for insider trading. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Trust me.
Now Chucky Gomez, Pop Rocks, wow. You know? Oh, man.
Yeah, that's the thing that you see, right? And it's the thing you can't tell somebody else. I mean, somebody else goes and does Pop Rock, and you're just copying a Jackson Pollock. And that's
now we got Pop Rocks on a brisket sandwich. See? It started, man. It's awesome. Anarchy and chaos. Pop Rock anarchy.
I like it. Hashtag Pop Rock.
Hashtag Pop Rocks. I should write that in there.
Did I answer that question?
That was a new one.
What the fuck was the question, right? No.
There you go.
I didn't remember what the question was. All right. What else, Donald?
I actually got another question I was going to ask you about. You know, so a lot of restaurants, you know, you can learn from them. You know, you learn sometimes from the big brands as a model. I think modeling is very important. You know, you've done NLP. I do NLP. Modeling is a very big part of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, by the way. And which brands out there, restaurant brands, do you think, or which restaurant brand, if you just think of one or two, which one do you think has the culture piece down?
If you're asking that in front of a global audience, right? So for the sake of anybody who would watch this, I'd have to answer it with something they would all know. I'll go back, kind of an underhand pitch. I'll go back to Starbucks. And again, you and I've had this talk. I'm not a corporate fanbagger. I don't love that kind of stuff at all. I like unique, eclectic. I like originals. But I'll hand it to Starbucks, and because it goes back to what I said at the onset about Howard Behar and that concept of how the employee was his customer and he treated them. They were everything. They were everything and his only thing. And if that's where you put your focus and the only place you put your focus, he didn't create culture in a way that was like intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Like not like sappy, corporate-y, gimmicky shit. It was genuinely, I talked to the guy last year. He's written a bunch of great cups, bunch of great books. One's called It's Not About the Coffee. It's a great book. And it's a great culture book.
Mm-hmm.
Now he wrote a new one last year called The Golden Cup. And it's a departure. It's more of a different story. But the guy's really, really smart. And he accidentally created this amazing culture just by caring about his employees and only caring about his employees. They saw that. They knew that. When a customer would say something or they would get a letter or somebody would rip them a new ass, you know, or post something negative about them, he would go, you know, he'd talk to the employee as like, here's what you have to understand. Customers are idiots, right? So how do I help you prevent that from happening? It never was finger in the chest. It was never, look at these reviews. It never took the side of the customer. It was the opposite. It always took the side of the employee. That, to me, was phenomenal. So that is a big one. And then, of course, you know, Southern California, shout out. I got to give it up to In-N-Out Burger. They are the culture mecca. You know, I mean, they have young kids, 18 to 25 working there.
Yeah.
Incredibly low turnover. And you know what I would say about both those examples, In-N-Out and Starbucks? If you ask somebody who works where they work and they work in fast food, you might see a little shame or trepidation come over their face when I have to admit it out loud. I have found that to be not true at all with Starbucks employees and In-N-Out employees.
Yes.
They have a badge of honor. That is a concept of culture right there, right? I will tell you, I did a very short stint when I was 16 in worked at Wendy's. And I got a buddy who was a big executive for Wendy's, and they used to have a great culture, but I was still embarrassed as shit to say that I ever worked there. You might be one of the only people now, anybody else who ever watches this as a simulcast knows, but I don't take any shame out of it, but I did then.
No.
Great exception to it then, because it was not my, it wasn't my vibe, you know what I mean?
Right.
I've been this starving artist my whole life, not the corporate sellout, man. The man, I don't like that. So those are two good cultures. Now, I could probably name 50 concepts that you don't know that I think have tremendous culture. One to talk about, a client, and I know that they wouldn't mind me sharing their name, called the Doghouse, H-A-U-S.
Mm-hmm.
Man, their culture is amazing. I was just there visiting last week, Friday, spent like 6 hours with them. It's never a meeting. It's meeting, and then it's lunch, and then it's happy hour drinks. And that's just how they treat everybody. And
yeah.
So down to earth. I mean, these guys have 500 restaurants sold nationwide. Huge deal. They were just in if you Google them, you'll see a ton of reviews. Like, I'm not talking reviews. I'm talking like upper echelon, you know, top three breakout concepts of the year, top 10 individual independents to watch, 40 under 40. You know, I mean, there are all these incredible reviews about them. And it's not just how the press talks about them. That's the same way that their staff talks about them. It's the same way that their customers, their guests talk about them. That's culture. You know what I mean? It's a 360. So those are some brands I like. I'll tell you, too, a random one. There's a concept called Marco's Coal-Fired Pizza. So I was interviewing this staff. I never saw so much transcendence in adoption of ownership behavior than I saw with this group. And I've known this group for a long time, since their inception, actually. But I've been out of touch with them for a long time, just started working with them again, first time in like 7 years. And that culture, it is so sticky. It is so incredible. Everybody's so empowered and so excited about the brand, especially a brand that's been around for 9 years. It's pretty powerful stuff. So there's the whole scope of it. Sorry, I know you said give you one. I gave you four.
Oh, that was good. So what are some, you know, I love your book, by the way. And so what are some outside the box operational hacks that people can use to improve their bottom line? Because I noticed in one of your books on food cost, you mentioned that changing the shape of the ice can have an impact on profits.
All right. So Kim Van Winkle said, what about employee turnover? I'm going to take hers instead of yours. I like hers better.
You like hers better?
Well, I mean,
smile at me, dude. That's just not fair, man.
I'll shamelessly plug. I mean, so you know, I have a food costing centricity to me. Wrote a book about food costs and menu engineering on a software company about it that I think is the best software in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Kim, not poor management. It is poor selection process, I think, is probably the biggest one. So there's a concept in human behavior that there's four elements that I look at specifically and that I train to and teach to when it comes to hiring people. The problem is most operators only hire for half of what they should be looking for. So if you imagine this quarter of a wheel pie chart split in half, the left side, stage right, is the top is experience, the bottom is decision making. And when you get somebody's resume or their application, you can look at their experience and then you like that. You're going to bring them in and talk to them and you're going to ask them these decision-making questions, which are bullshit, because I'm going to take the rote stuff that's off Google. Tell me about a situation where a customer made you uncomfortable and you knew you were right, but you didn't tell them.
I hate those questions.
Wow. I hate those questions. Yeah, questions. But here's the problem with those questions. The dumb who goes on Google as a hiring manager to look up good interview questions
is what he gets.
The same article as the guy applying for the job. And so he's read the bottom part of the question that says, here's the answers you should be looking for. And he just reverse engineers that into his answer, right? Mm-hmm. So for that part of it, you got to put people on the spot with decision-making questions. You know what I mean? They've got to be creative. They got to be unique. You can look at the experience, but experience doesn't tell everything. I'll give you an example. I've seen restaurants hire guys that they fall in love with.
Oh, yeah.
And here's a big problem. Oftentimes, we misplace what we think we're hiring. So I'm telling you, Donald, I see this weekly.
I see it all the time too.
Somebody, a GM. Oh, well, this GM came from the Cheesecake Factory, and before that, he was with the Hillstone Group. This dude walks on water. He's been doing it for 20 years. Awesome. Well, why is that so amazing to you? What about you is like that concept? Nothing. That's why it's great to me. Those guys have systems and structure and processes and growth charts and growth trigger indicators. And we don't have it, but we know we need it. So I'm going to hire this guy. And my head wants to explode. I say to myself, so let me get this right. You hired the builder hoping they could become the architect, right? They didn't draw the plans. They were given the plans and told where to put the hammer and the nail. And I see these guys fail in spite of themselves, both the restaurant and the person they hired, because they're disappointed, because they can't write and build an organized system. They never learned how to do that. They only learned how to manage to it.
Right. Now, they had the system handed to them.
Right. So that's one side of it. Now, the other side of it is the other stuff that we look at, right? So we use a tool, another shameless plug for a company that I believe in, amazing company, called PI, Predictive Index. And they do a really, really hard to crack behavioral personality survey. And I say a survey because it's not a test. If you look at like Myers-Briggs or what's the other one that everybody uses on the personality test?
I use ProScan, which is a behavioral survey.
Yeah, ProScan's not bad. The problem is the results show up like a test. And this is the challenge. So this,
I always tell them it's not a test too, unlike you.
It breaks it down the middle. It says there's four behaviors. You're more or less of this behavior. What I need to understand is for the position I'm hiring for, what's the behavior that's more favorable? Because if you exhibit this behavior, especially in large amounts of it, then I can feel pretty confident that this will come more easily and naturally to you. Here's how we are as human beings. There's no such thing as a procrastinator. There's just somebody who has a job that requires them to do shit that they hate to do. Right? And so more of that stuff that they have to do that they hate to do, they will procrastinate. The more of the stuff that they love to do is the stuff they'll get distracted by. They'll be great at, but they won't be complete. So PI looks at these four different indicators, says, are you an extrovert or are you an introvert, right? And guess what? We need both of them. My pilot on my plane that I'm on every week, I need him to be an introvert. Yes. I need him to be deep, right? I need him to be so deep in his vertical that he doesn't get distracted by dumb shit. Now, my front of the house manager, my GM, I don't need depth. I need width. I need those crazy restaurant eyes that when the dude turns off his car, within 15 seconds, he's in the restaurant talking to his AM saying, hey, shit all over the parking lot. Two light bulbs burnt out. Music's too loud. Shades aren't pulled. Heard somebody broke a glass as soon as I came in. And I don't even know why they had a glass in the back of the kitchen because we lost them all the car. And you're just like, holy shit, that's width. And you need those kind of people too. So I'm going to digress a little bit because I'm going crazy. Behavior is on the other side of this pie chart equation. And the last piece is learning aptitude. How quick can you pick things up? Mm-hmm. Here's another scenario that I've seen play out far too many times. We hired this guy. He was the chef of our competitor. He was there for 20 years, started as a dishwasher. Mm-hmm. This guy, I mean, loyal. He'll be around forever. Mm-hmm. Knows what he's doing. He's fast. Been doing this for, why do you think he knows what he's doing? He knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
That doesn't always translate into knowing what you're doing. Maybe I could flip the script and say, why did it take him 20 years to figure out how to do that job?
Right.
And that's what happens. You plug these people in with this great singular experience and they come over and it's not about architect or builder. They don't have to design stuff. They just have to build. But you gave them an electric saw and all they've ever used was a handsaw. And so the learning curve takes forever and you're shaking your head like, this guy has been doing this for 20 years. Did he lie on his resume? You call and check. No, this dude, he's
been there. Yeah.
Here for 5 years, then became a prep cook, then a line cook, then our head cook, and then our head chef, and then our KM. But maybe it took him 3 to 4 years to figure out how to do each job. Maybe the restaurant just promoted him desperately.
Right.
Anyway. So turnover is really flawed because primarily the site selection process. And I would add to that also when restaurants hire. And that seems really weird, right? When do they hire? Mm-hmm. Well, most people would say they hire when they need somebody. I say you hire always.
Always be hiring. As I tell,
you walk in the front door and say, "Are you guys hiring?" And you say, "No, not right now." You're wrong. Again, it goes back to that Howard Behar concept, people first. It's all about the people. If somebody comes in and they look good and they have confidence and mm-hmm. they say, "Hey, I wanted to introduce myself. I'm looking for this job, not a job, this job. I love this restaurant. I come here to eat all the time. I had a friend who used to work here." And you say, "Well, sorry, we're not hiring right now. Maybe give me your information or give me your email and I'll see if I know anybody in the industry." You're crazy. And how many of those did you miss because you didn't even engage and just said, "No, we're not hiring," or tell the hostess to tell them, "No, we're not hiring," right, or the server? You're always hiring. The Yankees became the Yankees, and they have more pennants than any other baseball team in history because of this model. They always top grade. They top grade. They have A players, B players, and C players. And they didn't care about the salary cap. They'll spend. They'll take fines. They'll take penalties. They don't care. If an amazing player is out on the open market and they're playing a position that somebody that I currently have on the team is not playing as well, A, that person knew that was our behavior and that's what we do. Right, and they knew what we needed them to do to be higher up there and protected, and they didn't. So guess what? I'm taking that B player and swapping him for the C all day long. Top grading. It's
game-changing.
Part in tandem to the whole turnover concept. And the third wheel of the turnover trike is culture.
Yes.
Doesn't matter how well you hire them. Doesn't matter how much you top grade. It's not up to you if they leave as much as it's up to them. So what are you doing to keep them? It goes back to that culture piece. If you're not engaged with them, if you don't care about them, if you don't show them how much you care, they won't care how much you know, and it'll blow up in your face. So toxic culture, to me, is more often than not a higher cause of departure than anything else. Mm-hmm. They do a survey subsequently. Every year they do the same survey. And every year the top four answers almost never change. When they talk about employee engagement, employee retention, they say, what's the number one reason why you would leave this job? What's the number two? What's number three? Number four?
They're always
number one. Number one is no clear path to growth. Mm-hmm. The company didn't offer any plan for me to go forward. So I left, right? So number two was it wasn't a culture fit. I don't feel like I fit in. I didn't like the culture. And oftentimes that doesn't mean the people around them. That means the people leading them. Then it was, I don't remember off the top of my head what three and four were, but I know that one of them is the income, right? I don't make enough money. But what's fascinating to me is that the money is always
later.
Always different. It's always third or fourth, mm-hmm. and it rotates sometimes. Number one and number two don't change.
Right.
That's fascinating. They haven't changed in 10 years, and they do this. I don't know if it's the Harvard Business Journal or who does it. Every single year they do it, and they interview thousands of businesses, and they ask the same
Harvard. I think it's Harvard does it every year.
It blows my mind that people aren't paying attention to that, you know? They get upset when the employee comes and knocks on the door and says, "I need a raise." "Well, I need you to do more work. I need you to be better. I need you to go from a C to a B." Well, no, they don't. If they've come to you asking for money, then I guarantee you've already let them down in at least one, if not two different places, right?
They're just using that as the final straw.
Yeah, that's like, look, all things being equal, this place sucks. The only thing that's going to keep me here is familiarity and more income.
That's it.
So anyway, Boy, sorry, Kim. Maybe she.
I think Kim's all right with that answer.
So long to answer that question, but you know the turnover piece is definitely a good piece.
That's a good piece.
You brought up a food cost thing. I'm going to answer that one too. Until the cameras shut off, I'm going to keep talking. Yeah,
we'll go until they shut us down, man.
All right. So on the food cost, I will give you a cool hack that I have on food cost. So I gave you the book report hack. I gave you the camera hat hack.
That's a good one.
So those are some simple hacks. On a food cost hack, if you're really looking at food cost and mm-hmm. you're making inventory, This is one of the coolest hacks I know. So you have your make line, right? Every kitchen has a make line, right? Mm-hmm. You got third pans, your sixth pans, your ninth pans, you got all your shit in there. You got your lettuce, your cheese, onions, all your prep. Everything's right there, right? The average cost of a full line in the industry is about $700, $400 to $700, depending on the size. But take that as a pretty good threshold.
Okay.
Not counting that is critical. Overcounting that can have a variance of double the cost. So we make a recipe of our line, and we weigh out how much is every one of these things full, and multiply those ounces by the cost of that product per ounce, and you build it like it's a recipe, right? So it's third pan of cheddar equals 80 ounces at 5 cents an ounce equals $4 or whatever the hell that costs, right? Mm-hmm. For every single item, you make this entire recipe, and you have a cost for that recipe. The line full equals $642.
Right.
Before you count inventory, which is just good stewardship in your closing shift anyway, fill the whole line. Just fill the whole line before you count anything. Mark that as a one, and then move on and count everything else. And you're not taking stuff out and weighing it or guessing. You're not skipping it and missing $300 that could affect your bonus because mm-hmm. you just decided to, you know, or you erred on the side of caution or you erred on the side of progress and guessed too much. So it is, to me, it's a really, really cool hack that I found. I like to do a lot of hacks like that when it comes to counting inventory because it's an arduous, terrible process.
Yeah.
So that's a good easy takeaway.
That's a good easy hack. So let's talk about recipes, you know, and let's talk about a recipe. If you're going to make a recipe for success, what three ingredients or core values would you say have to be in there for people?
All right. So I'm a greedy fucker. If you haven't noticed that, I can't give you three of anything. I'll give you four.
Good.
Number one, passion.
Yes.
And chase it down like a mofo. Run towards it all day, every day. Don't worry about what anybody thinks. Trust me, it pays off. Passion is the main ingredient. Mm-hmm. Then the supporting cast. Number one in the supporting cast is curiosity.
Yes.
Be curious. Stay curious about everything. About everything. I'm curious about a lot of things, a lot more than just food, than restauranting. I'm curious about leadership. I'm curious about mm-hmm. book writing. I'm curious about all kinds of things. But what I'll tell you is, in a very Zen way, everything is connected to everything.
Yes.
Business is business is business. People are people are people. When you start exploring these curiosities, you start mm-hmm. finding these incredible parallels, and you think, man, I'm in the restaurant industry. They don't do this, but I'm over here at church, and I see the way that they treat people, and I look at the result they get. I need to adopt that. Or I see this business process that my parents use in their mechanic business, and I can't believe the restaurant business never stumbled onto that or this. Or, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. be curious and explore the curiosity. That would be my first member of the supporting cast to passion. Number two, humility.
Oh, yeah.
I'm reminded of this every day. I mean, you walk in thinking you know something, and my mind is blown every day by people who do something better than anybody's ever imagined or thought of. I put it in my bucket and I mm-hmm. try to give them tons more in return. You know, I'm grateful, attitude of gratitude, right? That's kind of yeah. hand in hand with humility. Humility and gratitude, I think, are one answer. Then third member of my supporting cast and final member would be collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
What you and I are doing. So there's this concept I believe in when it comes to collaboration. You are one person. I am one person. One and one is not two. It's 11. You see what I'm doing here? It's 11.
Oh, yeah.
It's got a 10x multiplier. It genuinely does. Because without bouncing an idea off of somebody and hearing their retort, you won't get to your better idea. And as that keeps multiplying, when you bounce ideas back and forth, you and I do. Me and my buddy Thax do this all the time. I've got a lot of people out there that if they will, I will collaborate all day long. I chase my curiosity. I find those people. I chase my curiosity, lead with my passion, show a lot of humility, and all of a sudden people are willing to collaborate with me. And I am more than willing to collaborate back. Give as good as you get, right? Try to give more if you can. That's my success formula. And that's not just what I use. It's what I've modeled and studied. I look at people who have amazing quality of life, great income, great family, great values, all the things, the trinkets and the trash and the shit and the cars and the houses. It's about all of it, right? Like I said, I don't want to make $1 million working 100 hours a week. I want to make it working 40,
that's, you know?
So if the whole picture, that would be my recipe. That is my, that's my mise en place, brother.
That's a good one.
That's my bay leaf. That is my bay leaf.
Ooh, nice.
Amazing, and you don't even see it. It's never present in the dish.
Boom. As Thax would say, our good friend Thax Turner would say, boom.
Bang, boom, man. That's it.
Boom.
Kim, you're too kind.
Kim's very kind. Kim's been an all-star tonight, hanging through the whole broadcast, hanging in there. You know, and thank you to everyone who's who participated tonight and asked questions. Chucky, Chef Eduardo, all you guys were great. And Joey, for asking all kinds of great questions and stuff like that. We really appreciate the interaction. It really makes it a lot more fun for us. So,
yeah, thanks for hanging with.
Yeah,
my So as restaurant people, the ADD part, it, you know, we just shiny shit all the time, man, and. Sorry. I appreciate everybody who hung in.
So if people don't know, you and I are speaking in New Mexico next week. We're doing a seminar. It's a first of a series that we're going to be putting together, and it's sponsored. We're going to do a shameless self plug for Shamrock Foods. Shamrock Foods is a very, very innovative food distribution company, and they dominate the Southwest. And they actually have the foresight to help put together from the idea of Thax Turner. And they're doing this thing called the 10X Profit Series. And we are doing the first one next week in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at the Hispanic Cultural Center on May 9th. It's pretty close to sold out, I think. I think there's only a few seats left from what I understand. So,
yeah,
if you're a customer, you might want to try to get in, but it might be tough now, so. But we're going to do more of these.
So excited about this event. It will be like tonight's conversation with organization, right?
Yeah.
And a lot more like really cool takeaways, some really, really good stuff. The good, the bad, the ugly about restauranting, the hacks, the tips, the tricks, so much of it in a good formula, good order.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking forward. It's, you and I have done a lot of collaboration in different capacities, but never right. You know, up in front of people, and I'm really excited to do that with you, dude. It's gonna be a great time.
That's awesome. Yeah, are you going to the NRA show this year? Or are you gonna? Yeah, I know you got some conflict.
Allegedly.
You got a client.
Yeah, it's all.
Let's ask listeners out there, what do they think you should do? I mean, should he go to the big, boring, you know, very, very kind of, you know, same old NRA show, or would you, if it was your option? Would you go hang down on a yacht down in Mexico with some clients? I'm saying I won't see you in Chicago this year.
I'm really torn right now, I got to tell you, because I'm passionate about having fun, but I'm also passionate about what I do. I always make great connections. I always see or find really cool stuff at the NRA. Mm-hmm. I love eating my way through Chicago. You know, there's incredible, charming little places that don't get the notoriety mm-hmm. that they should, that are just epic. And the experiences, man, I got to tell you, I got a problem with saying yes to any invite that I've never had before. This is mm-hmm. my deal. And a lot of my friends know this. So if they surprise me with some weird random shit and invite me to do something I've never done, it's an automatic yes.
I'm in. Yeah.
Right. Like, I don't know if I like that or hate it. I don't know if I have an opinion right now.
Yeah, I'll be at the NRA show this year. I'll be probably hanging out at the Foodable TV broadcasting booth, and then I'll also be doing. I do a lot of stuff with Hot Schedules. So I'll be probably hanging at the Hot Schedules booth too. So if you're in Chicago at the NRA show, please get on Facebook, send me a message, let me know you're there. I'll be doing some updates. I'll be doing a lot of live streaming this year from the NRA show. So Facebook Live, Instagram Live, live stream on Twitter. I'm going to hit all of it. That's my goal. Is I'm just going to be until the battery goes dead. I'm going to be broadcasting until the battery goes out. So
if anybody goes, what would you say is a must see, and what would you say is a all hype, all sizzle, no steak?
I love the technology area because I think that's the new and upcoming stuff. I tend to hang out in the technology area. That's my big thing. Plates are plates. I stay away from the plates. There's usually some really cool hot trends. Like last year, Pepsi came out with this kind of craft soda concept.
Yeah.
Stubborn soda. And that was really kind of cool. And, you know, the craft soda kind of revolution was kind of taking off. There are some really cool things. I like some of the technology, especially since we talk about labor, you know, tightening up, and it's hard to find people. I like to go at stuff that actually can help kind of ease the burden on the line. So I like to hang out. I check out the Turbo Chef booth usually, and some of their new kind of rapid technology they have that doesn't sacrifice quality. There's some really cool cutting edge equipment out there that I usually tend to hang out by. I don't want to eat another gelato if I don't have to. Everybody has a new gelato every year. I don't need gelato, trust me.
You bring up a good point, though. I think this is what this would be a note to distributors and vendors, because this is interesting you said this, and I've had this conversation with other people. I'm less inclined to go to a food service distributor, mm-hmm. no offense, to get a new food idea. Yeah. I'm more inclined to get some type of innovation, especially as it surrounds efficiency. We'll go back to that concept of $10 an hour work versus $500 an hour work. You're not going to put a cool enough food item in front of me that's going to make me think, wow, that's $500 an hour work. But those efficiencies, technology, the cooking equipment, design and aesthetic is cool. I love seeing that. Mm-hmm. I do spend a little time looking at plates and glasses just to see if anybody's come up with anything, you know. But most of the time, my glassware and plateware concepts are very similar to my food. I might see something that triggers inspiration for me to go do it myself or a different way. Rarely do I ever just want to buy the thing that is the commodity that everybody else can buy, which is don't do it. And that's the same thing on food, right? Whatever this hot food trend is, well, that's great. Your sriracha mayo, fantastic.
I know.
Stop. Yeah, stop doing that. You know. That's where I tend to look at too. I like the black carpet side, man, has gotten really good. The bar side, I'm going to tell you, has really taken
really, I don't even go there. When I go to the NRA, I don't even go to the bar side anymore.
Used to be 10 times bigger. Now it's all small. Yeah. It's all these handlebar mustache guys talking about how they squeeze the juniper with ass cloth and all this random stuff. And I'm like, you know, then beat it with a birch tree or some shit. You know, I have no idea what's going on.
Picked by vestal virgins, you know.
I'm so over that side of it. But anyway, that's I love craft. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I like craft too. But
when you've corporatized the craft,
is it really craft anymore?
Yeah, is it really craft? Yeah. So yeah,
when you've diluted it so much, is it still craft? You know.
Yeah. When it's mass produced. So,
I just want to say thanks to Bo for taking the time tonight, and I'll have links up here for posts. Anyone interested in contacting Bo? For ways to improve your restaurant game. We'll also go on Amazon. You can pick up any of his books. He has some great books on food costs. He also has a great book on marketing, Whisper Marketing, right?
Whisper Marketing, yep.
Yeah, it's a great one. I love that one too. So in closing, here's what I want to say. I want to say ego, pride, and denial close more restaurants than you think, and it's sad because they could change that. You know, if you need help, reach out and ask for help. You know, look to other restaurants as an example of what to do, and look at some as an example of what not to do. There are some amazing brands out there that you can use as a model for success. You just have to have an open mind and be willing to learn. Learning, adapting, and change. These are the three best tools that you have to improve your business today. And if you're looking for more tools, actually, to take your restaurant to the next level, please go by and check out the Restaurant Coach University. There are online courses on there that will help you build your brand, strengthen your team, and increase your profits. All you need to do is take action and go over and sign up for the free VIP list at www.restaurantcoachuniversity.com. restaurantcoachuniversity.com. And with that, we are going to say, anything else you want to say, Bo?
Yes. sorry, you made a comment about modeling, and I can't let this end without making a comment about that. As much as I love modeling, I will tell you, it ranks up there in my top five bad behaviors of operators. If you're going to model something, understand the whole model, right?
Yeah, that's true. They pick pieces.
Yeah, those badass wheels did not make that car sell for $100,000. It was the engine. It was the paint. It was the design. You can't rock those rims on your primer gray Honda and think it's going to get the same effect. It's not. You can't put it on Craigslist for $100,000 now. Don't do it. When you model, pay attention to the big picture, and then modeling that way makes sense for you. That's how I would end it.
That probably would be the biggest thing, is that when people do model, they cherry pick of what they want, and you can't do that. You got to model the whole. It's just like, you know, it's like, wow, you know, I like that athlete's, you know, this, and I like that guy's this, you know, when you're, and then you just can't piece it together, and then, you know, like a Frankenstein, and think it's going to perform.
Right. I can't go to my doctor, and, you know, I actually did. I blew out both my rotator cuffs this year. Level 4 tear over here, level 3 over here. And I'm going, and he's giving me these ointments to rub, and he's giving me these pills to take, and then he's giving me these exercises to do. Well, I'm taking the pills, I'm rubbing the ointment, I'm not doing the exercises. And I go in, and I'm bitching about how it's not working. He's like, you take the pills? Yeah, I'm taking the pills. You're rubbing the ointment on? Yeah. 2 times a day? Most of the time, no. Yeah. I try. Are you doing the exercises? Yeah. Every day? No? Oh, don't point your finger at me telling me it's not working. You're not working. Right. That's the best way I could compare it. You can't take the entire prescription for the success and only have, you know, part of the formula and think you're going to get better.
You got to do the work. Robin Sharma has a big thing. He says, you know, people, you know, of course, you know, he's one of those online guys, does a lot of motivational stuff, sells a lot of seminars. And he says, you know, people call and say, well, you know, I downloaded your course, but it didn't work. And he said, well, did you do the work? And they go, no, but, you know, well, don't do the work. It's not, you know, don't expect results if you're not willing to put in the work. So.
Yeah, silver bullets don't work without a gun. You got to have
the gun, man. Yeah. Got to have the vehicle.
Yeah.
That's it.
Thanks for having me, Donald. I really enjoyed this.
So much, Bo. Appreciate it so much.
I'd love to come back when you want me to. I enjoy
that. Yeah, we'll have you on again. Yeah, this is a good fun format. So I want to say good night to everyone out there in Facebook land. And probably this episode will be probably in about a week. You'll see it, find it up on iTunes and Stitcher Radio on the Restaurant Coach Podcast. And with that, we say good night.
Thanks for listening to the Restaurant Coach Podcast with Donald Burns. Tune in next time as we serve up more ways to maximize your potential. Visit our website at www.donaldburns.net or download episodes at iTunes and Stitcher Radio.